The Pac-12 power rankings are shaking out a little bit easier after week 9. There's so many nail biters and there's so many blowouts. It's still hard to predict who's going to win, but we know who still has a chance at the conference championship and the college football playoff. What was up with Wazoo on 24/7? Also, UCLA got a game canceled on them by Michigan. Now they're going to have to play probably FCS teams. And also, we're going to talk about the playoff run and debate the Pac-12 power rankings. I'm George Reister with Ralph Amston, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. Ralph, week 9, it was absolutely awesome. We had nail biters and we had blowouts. And it is clear. I hope you are keeping a tally, that you're still keeping an accurate tally of these wins and losses, because your boy over here is doing quite well.
I think you had a pretty good couple of weeks these last 2 weeks. I mean, you may have had a little bit of help in one or two occasions from some Pac-12 refs, but I would say that they were trying to do you some harm on the other ones unsuccessfully. It's been a crazy couple of weeks, and I think this was probably the worst officiated week so far of the season, but we are starting to see teams separate themselves. The cream is definitely rising to the top.
Speaking of the refs, I was almost getting ready to say, wow, the Pac-12 refs haven't been that bad. I was been watching a little more SEC football, particularly the Florida-South Carolina game, which was an officiating disaster. I've been seeing some of my SEC fans, friends, tweet about how bad the officiating is, controversies, all of that. And I'm sitting here saying, oh, wow, guess what? Maybe the Pac-12 has it fixed. And this week was atrocious. We saw bad targeting fouls. We saw, in the Oregon-Washington State game was the worst officiated game that I think I have seen in the Pac-12
this year. Yeah, I mean, UCLA-ASU was trying to give it a little bit of a run for its money. And there was definitely some questionable stuff in Colorado-USC as well. It was just a bad week, honestly. And it's part of it, right? Like, that's part of the experience of being a Pac-12 football fan, is having to deal with the fact that calls are going to be inconsistent, that they're not going to make any sense. They're going to defy common wisdom of all types. I mean, Penei Sewell got called for a false start. One of the most blatant missed calls I've seen in my life is Penei Sewell getting called for a false start for getting trucked. Yeah, I mean, it's not like he's got a body of work of absolute perfection or anything, you know. So they couldn't even give him the benefit of the doubt. That one was terrible. ASU UCLA was just brutal. Chase Cota ran out of bounds, came back in bounds, made a fantastic catch on the sideline, which the refs incorrectly call incomplete, and then go in to review it. And not only do they miss the fact that he, on his own, went out of bounds and came back in, and a ref dropped their hat. A ref threw their hat onto the ground. Ref threw their hat, like, indicating that the receiver had been out of bounds. They go back and overturn the call, which I believe was a third and long, that UCLA ends up scoring on. Like, they give UCLA this unnecessary gift, because UCLA was already doing fine on their own. That set the tone for basically how that entire game was officiated. There were two personal fouls called in that game, one from Eno trying to give the ball back to the ref, but he wasn't paying attention, so it bounced off his chest, and another for Ashari Crosswell. An incomplete pass was so off target from DTR that it bounced near Ashari's foot, so he kicked it. Like, it was on the bounce, and he kicked it, and he got hit with a personal foul. And it was almost like in that game, the refs said, like, oh, ASU's getting a little chippy off that Utah thing. We're going to watch him extra close and, you know, and throw some flags.
So, Ralph, what did you think of that targeting penalty in UCLA, number 24, on that two-point conversion? I was sitting there. I was like, how else are you supposed to a little guy supposed to tackle a big guy on the goal line to stop him from getting in?
I hated it. I know you hated it too. I understand why you hated it. But he got him in the face with his helmet, and his head was lowered. I think they're trying at this point to protect defenders from themselves. Didn't like the flag. Wish it wouldn't have been thrown. But at the same time, like, you have to protect yourself. I'm not sure he could have hit him with the force that he did
if he had his face mask up. I mean, it looked like, it honestly looked like he just had him dead squared up, and maybe it wasn't necessary. Then again, Ethan Long shouldn't have really been in that position. He had real estate for days on both sides. If he didn't, you know, he's a freshman quarterback playing sort of a hybrid H-back position. You're not going to be able to truck, you know, somebody who's in their third, fourth year. You can't overestimate your physicality in that situation. I think he got himself blown up, and I hate that Arizona State was rewarded for it. I hate that 24 was tossed. I don't understand. I don't understand why they can't be like levels to
yeah.
this. Whereas because it was not, there's no way that this was intentional. I think they're trying to protect the defenders from themselves. Yeah. Keep your head up, keep yourself safe. As I'm absolutely scared to death of the fact that some of these guys lower their head and how it could injure them. But yeah, I didn't like it. I get why they threw the flag, but
The problem is this, is that especially when it's a play where you're trying to stop someone from either A, getting a first down or a touchdown, and you have to collide with such force to stop the other person, because I'm okay with targeting penalties when a guy is, you know, defenseless or doesn't see you coming, is held up by another player. I'm all in on those. Or when quarterback sliding, but when somebody sees you coming and you're like, all right, let's man up and see who wins. I mean, how is a defender supposed to stop from falling backwards and giving up first downs and touchdowns? Because you have to be moving with such force and lower your head even a little bit to create the force and the upward angle to be able to deliver a powerful punch. You can't take your head off and drop it on the side and say, oh, well, I'm just going to run into him with my chest. Because anybody that's ever played football knows if you run into somebody with your chest, you're going to get run over.
Yeah, honestly, there's not a single person on UCLA's campus that's not going to pat him on the back this week. And there's not a single football fan that I know that doesn't think that was like clean and just a great hit. The way that the rules are, you have to keep your head up, and you know he may not have been able to make the play if he did. But I don't see anything wrong with it. I'm not going to be like Utah fans were last week after Evan Fields went helmet to helmet with Zach Moss and turn it into a giant thing where they're writing him letters telling him to go F off and die, and the Utah AD has to issue a statement saying that doesn't represent, you know, our university, yada, yada, yada. I think every ASU fan will be like, man, that was a good hit, but you know, we're glad we were able to get the 2-point conversion out of it. I don't see ASU fans going the Utah fan route on this one.
Speaking of players coming in, out of games, I'm sitting there and, okay, so last week in the Utah game, Zach Moss clearly looked like he may have been knocked out and came back in the game. And I'm sitting there like, how is this possible? And the same thing happened, I think, yesterday in the Oregon game. Guy was out, number 37 for Washington State. Out, night, sleepy. And then he comes back in the game. I'm like, how are these people passing concussion protocol? Like, it's not possible. I'm concerned about the kids. I'm saying, all right, so of course the kids want to play. They're going to say, I'm not having any symptoms. But if you were knocked out, clearly, the video shows the person laid out on the ground, eyes closed. You can't come back in the game at that point. That's silliness.
Yeah, I mean, I think what MMA has 40 days, 90 day and 6 month medical suspensions for different stuff that happens to you. You know, in the ring, there's a medical suspension for blood, a medical suspension for getting knocked out, regardless of whether you get a concussion or not, medical suspension for breaking a bone or a giant laceration. You know, there's different things where it just keeps the fighter from endangering themselves any further than they are by just participating in the sport regardless. You know, I think football might end up coming to some type of place where if it looks like you get KO'd, if the medical staff has to come out and huddle around you, laying on your back on the ground, if they end up even having to ask you your own name, then maybe you don't come back in because once you know what concussion protocol is, And I know that there shouldn't be a situation where it's like, oh, it's a test you can study for and pass. But once you know what concussion protocol is, I mean, wouldn't it be a little bit easier to pass yourself off for ready to go back into a game?
Yes, dude. I know guys when, especially after you get a concussion. So in the preseason, all teams do a baseline test. And during the season, if you get a concussion, you have to take these certain tests. Some of them are on the computer, all of this. And if your scores aren't close enough to your baseline, then you pass. But I know guys who have intentionally done a bad job on the baseline test. The way if they do get a concussion, they can still turn around and play. It's bad news for the players, bad news for everybody. But before we get into our Pac-12 power rankings, Ralph, wanted to touch on this schedule thing because I always beat the drum on schedules in the Pac-12, SEC, Big 10, Big 12, ACC, all of them. People scheduling bad teams. UCLA had Michigan on their schedule for 2022, 2023. Mind you, there's teams that are scheduled all the way to 2030. And you see now that Michigan canceled the games, had to pay UCLA $1.5 million, and now UCLA is left with nothing on their schedule in 2022 and 2023. They have, in 2022, they have Bowling Green, South Alabama, and an open spot now. And in 2023, San Diego State, Coastal Carolina. And I'm saying, how are you supposed to win anything like that when this is your schedule? And why did Michigan cancel?
I don't know. Coastal Carolina, South Alabama, no disrespect to them whatsoever. You know, I'm sure South Alabama still will have a few talented players, Saban cast-offs by then, and Coastal Carolina, great baseball school. But I don't really know what to say about that. UCLA, you know, goes out of their way to make sure they've got decent out-of-conference games. They always have. And now Michigan pays $1.5 million to break this contract. And you might be saying to yourself, 2022, that's far off. But a lot of these games are scheduled out all the way through 2029. That's sooner than a lot of teams, decent opponents, are already going to be full up. I know that Florida's AD tweeted the other day, like, hey, let's make a home and home happen. And we, even on this podcast, said UCLA would be a great opponent for them. But who knows why Michigan? Maybe Michigan saw an opening to schedule Florida, and that's why they ditched UCLA. I know that, you know, one of your theories is that maybe Michigan doesn't want to schedule as tough as having UCLA as an out-of-conference game. So I can only speculate as to why it was done, but I can tell you this. One thing I don't want to hear out of anybody at Michigan's mouth, whether they're administrator, an assistant coach, or Jim Harbaugh himself, they better not make any comment about how your word is your word and commitment is commitment when it comes to recruiting, because they literally just broke a freaking contract. So can we get away from all this stuff? You know, like Mel Tucker the other day saying that there's no transfer portal in real life. Okay. Like Mel Tucker's had 9 jobs. Like life is nothing about college football prepares you for the real world quite like the transfer portal. So, So this is just another example of a thing where it's going to come back to bite Jim Harbaugh when he's talking about some recruit that breaks their commitment to Michigan to go somewhere else. And he says, well, in society these days, we just have different values. Like, okay, well then keep your commitment and play UCLA in 2022 and 2023.
Yep. And keep your commitment, honor your contract. Don't leave for another job either. Until your contract is over. I don't know who they're going to be able to schedule because it's so late in the game that all the big boys are scheduled at this point in time. It will be interesting to see who they get. What are your Pac-12 power rankings, Ralph?
Oh, my gosh. What a mess. I guess we're stuck with Colorado on the bottom this week, even though they played well, which doesn't feel good at all. And again, Washington State played well, and I have them at 11. So that just goes to show you how much of a mess the Pac-12 is. I got, you know, Arizona has that win over UCLA, so I think that you have to give them a modicum of respect. So I have them coming in at number 10. My number 9 is Oregon State. Geez. I got to say that at this point, my number eight is probably Arizona State, because they've looked completely inept in almost every facet of the game for the last 2 weeks, even though you know they've got a bunch of talent, which would make my number seven a Cal team without a quarterback, I guess. Or did I not? Yeah, I mean, I see the Cal's defense to me is still as elite as it was. And I know that if you just plugged in one player on the offensive side of the ball, they probably would have two more wins than they have right now. And so I, you know, that makes no sense, but I don't care. You go ahead and give me your bottom.
My bottom is I have Cal at number 12. They have no quarterback, can't do anything. This team is toothless at this point, even though that they have a really good defense. Got Colorado at 11. Even though they played better, they're still just spiraling downhill. Arizona at number 10, because they don't want to know who they are, and until they pick a quarterback, they're going to continue to lose. Stanford at number 9. They played much better, but the team that's in front of them is number 8, UCLA, who beat them a week ago. So sorry, you know, you are your record at this point. Number 7, and I got Oregon State at number 7.
Okay. I'll probably go just instead of a 5-6, I'll go for a tie for 5th, and that's two teams that I don't believe are good football teams, but already have 3 wins in the Pac-12, and that's Stanford and UCLA. I'll put USC as my number 4. Washington is my number 3, Utah 2, and Oregon is a resounding number 1 at 5-0 in the conference.
I totally agree. I don't agree with your assessment of it, with your rankings, but I can't argue with them. It's not terrible. I mean, it's so, like, you can't argue with these things at this point in time in the season when teams have been so up and down. I have Arizona State at number 6. Their body of work in the beginning was really good, but they're falling apart. But, I mean, who are they? Are they better than Oregon State, UCLA, Stanford, Arizona, Colorado?
I don't know, because now you start taking like a 10,000-foot view of Arizona State, and you look at the fact that they struggled to beat their first two opponents who were not very good, and you're like, oh, are we saying that because they had 5 wins, are we giving them more credit than they probably should have had? And so they're a very confusing team right now.
Yeah, and I got 5 Washington State. They're still competitive. They're a good team. Hard to beat. USC, number 4. Washington, 3. Utah, 2. And clearly, number 1 team is Oregon. They're getting everybody's best shot at this point in time. Oh, another thing that happened this week was 24-7. We talked about it when Arizona State was on it, and now Washington State was on it the following week. So it was pretty cool because it was the Arizona State was leading up to the Washington State game, and then they showed it. And then when the Washington State started, you got a chance to see the other side of that game and how Washington State dealt with it and then went into their next week. What was your takeaway from that 24-7 round?
You and I talked a little bit before we started recording on that maybe Washington State wasn't the best follow-up for after being, you know, in with Herm Edwards. And I feel like nationally, ASU probably got a little bit more shine off this than Washington State did. I maybe disagree with it a little bit in that I just loved the contrast of, you know, you have Ray Anderson bringing in Marvin Lewis and Herm Edwards and Antonio Pierce and Kevin Mawai and trying to shape this into a pro model of doing things. And then you immediately pick up your camera crew and you head to Pullman for the most college-like atmosphere and the most college-like staff that I think maybe exists in all of Power 5 football. And I love the contrast of it so much. Those two things, if you were to watch them back to back, it would be striking, the difference. And
Herm Edwards talks to the players versus how Mike Leach talks to the players.
So that was a big thing. That was a big thing. When you watch Herm, you're like, oh, he's the same person that he always is. When you watch Mike Leach, you're like, oh, he's kind of a dick.
Oh, yeah. And you're thinking, would I want my son talk to like Herm Edwards talks to him, or would I want him to talk to like Mike Leach talks to him? Because it almost felt, he reminds me of the dude, a little bit toned down version of the dude from Last Chance U. That's who he reminds me of.
Yeah, okay, so at least Jason Brown, who I have no respect for whatsoever, Jason Brown is a guy that's 100% governed by his emotions. Mike Leach is, like, muted in all things. Like, he'll tell a kid he sucks without raising his voice, without even being like, well, you suck. Well, that's your problem. I guess it's my problem for recruiting you. Moving on to the next thing. The way that he talks, he manages to talk down to his players without escalating or de-escalating. Like, he keeps the same energy no matter what he's doing, and it kind of comes off as passive aggressive, and maybe it makes it easier to not get your feelings hurt, because it's like, did that guy just verbally slap me, or does it even matter to him? Like, he just kind of moved on. Like, he doesn't seem like he's personally offended. He was offended enough to bring up my play. Like, he wants me to change. I get that, but like, is he upset? But it's just, what a weird situation. But also the thing about Mike Leach is it seems like the players that buy into the fact that he's just going to kind of calmly roast them in front of everybody sometimes have a really good, close relationship with him.
I think it's more the quarterbacks. I don't know. It's hard to. I think it's hard to have a close relationship with a coach who does stuff like that. But the difference between him and Herm was so noticeable that it's hard to really fathom, like, that recruits. I mean, mind you, Washington State and Arizona State aren't competing for the same recruits.
Not really. Yeah, you're right.
Washington
Not really.
State is competing with Oregon State for recruits. They're competing. I mean, that's just the truth. They're competing probably with Arizona, Oregon State.
Utah.
Yeah, and Utah probably even has a little bit of a leg up depending on the geography. You know, so, yep, so.
Yeah. I tell you what, though, there were a couple of things that, so, just as a one positive that stood out to me was, well, first of all, the collegiate atmosphere. I mean, the Hunter McGinnis, like, up there acting like a DJ while they all, like, dance to techno, how loose they keep their walkthroughs and everything like that, I thought that was pretty cool. And then the hours that Mike Leach keeps, like, there are a lot of people that put in a lot of work in college football. You can't really call anybody lazy if they're a college football coach. Maybe they don't put in as much work as somebody else. Maybe you can get lazy with certain things over time. But man, Mike Leach is just working, and he's got so many responsibilities. Yeah. He is that team. Like, and not on the defensive side of the ball is basically like a bunch of coaches all working together to come up with a game plan. But I've never seen anybody who owns as much of the offensive side of the football as Mike Leach. And now I know where Cliff Kingsbury gets it from, like why he is the way he is, because Mike Leach is, he owns the quarterbacks. He owns the entire offense. And then he's the CEO above everything. He takes more media than anyone else. Like, he's just, that guy is working.
And
24/7.
Another thing on there was, okay, so Tracy Clays was their defensive coordinator who left. And Mike Leach on there said that he didn't even talk to him, that he just left a note and was gone. And I found that very striking, because seeing how Mike Leach talked to the players and being in coaches' meetings before, knowing how sometimes those get extremely heated. I know what was going on with Mario Cristobal and Jim Leavitt. They almost came to blows a couple times. So I imagine Tracy Clays and Mike Leach had it out. Probably Mike Leach saying some very choice words to him. Tracy Clays didn't appreciate it and was like, yo, I'm not working for you no more. I'm out. That's the way I imagine that went down.
There's zero chance that Mike Leach didn't disrespect Tracy Clays.
Oh, yeah.
Almost, I mean, everything about the way Mike Leach talked is, in a sense, disrespectful. I mean, he gets away with it because I think that you, as a player, I think you can assume that his intent is that you be better. But it's tough for a grown man to be to sort of have a relationship with somebody who is passive aggressive. And I don't get along with passive aggressive people very much because I'm a very direct person. If I was in a business relationship with somebody who was my superior, who made just offhanded comments all of the time that were sort of direct but indirect at the same time, that I don't know if I could deal with that either. It's not great to walk out on your team or whatever, but he obviously felt like the situation was untenable. I remember we talked about on this podcast that I thought that the way that he phrased the way, you know, that they need one unifying voice, and he would fall on that grenade and take himself out of the picture. I thought that that was great, and I still think that that's great, and I think it's probably working out for them a little bit better than the direction that it was trending. But the truth is, like, there's just some people that it's hard to work for if that's not something that you're willing to eat. If you're not willing to eat that amount of bullshit, it's going to be untenable.
100%. Well, there are some teams that are thriving at this point in time and clearly have a chance at the college football playoff. In the AP poll that came out, Oregon is at 7, Utah is at number 9, and in my college football top 10 power rankings, week 10, as it should be, because I go no bias, no bull, just college football rankings based upon schedules and all of that at Unafraid Show. You guys go see that. And also tell a friend about the Pac-12 Apostles podcast. And me and Ralph do this, but this is for us. This is for Pac-12 fans. This is people who want to know about the Pac-12. Share it, tell a friend about it, all these things. And in there, I have Utah number 8 and I have Oregon number 6 in there. So in there, I have Ohio State 1, LSU 2, Penn State 3, Bama 4, Clemson 5, because neither one of them has played a team even ranked in the top 25. Oregon 6, Florida 7, Utah 8, Baylor 9, and Oklahoma 10. So there was so many people that said that the Pac-12 was out of the playoff conversation when Oregon lost to Auburn, but they were only down for 9 seconds. I mean, so it was as good as lost as possible. And now with two teams ranked in the top 10 in the AP poll and kind of having almost a clear path toward the Pac-12 championship, and some of these other teams have to play, provided Utah and Oregon finish 11-1, you're going to have one of them be a top. Well, you're probably going to have a 5-6 matchup or a 4-6 matchup for the Pac-12 championship. So it's going to be tough to think of a scenario where a 12-1 at this point in time, a 12-1 Pac-12 champion gets left out of the playoffs.
Yeah, I think Oregon's path is very simple. Win and you're in. Win every game and you should be fine. That's as simple as it gets. That's the same deal that everybody in even more respected conferences around the country have. Win and you're in. Oregon has put themselves in that position. They should be grateful for it. Keep your nose to the grindstone. They can do some positive things down the road. Utah needs several things to happen. They need not only USC to lose a game that they probably shouldn't lose, but then to turn around and win the rest of their games after losing whatever game that is. Then Utah has to win out, and then they have to find a way to beat Oregon.
Yeah, well, the thing, though, Ralph, is that Utah's in a good spot in that if Oregon wins all of their games, then that means that Utah's going to win the South because Oregon plays USC.
Yeah, that's fair.
So if Oregon wins all their games, then if Utah wins all the rest of theirs, then that's what you get in the Pac-12 championship because then USC would have 2 Pac-12 South losses. I mean, because that would be terrible, a terrible deal if USC wins out and you have an 11-1 Utah team that doesn't even make the Pac-12 championship.
So basically, USC getting back to being USC will hurt the entire Pac-12. That's amazing.
I know, dude, when everybody said that the conference needs them to be good for the conference.
And now you need the exact opposite. Oh, that's wild to think about. And I mean, what's crazy is they have the talent to where you can't completely put it out of your imagination that it's possible. It's going to be a tough, road for USC, but it's possible that they play.
Is it really possible? We can get into the games now because they played on Friday. They played at Colorado. Colorado was up in this game. And it felt like Mel Tucker didn't play to win the game. He knows his defense is super shoddy. What was it? 4th and 4 on their own. I mean, on USC's 38 with 6 minutes to go. And you punt the football knowing your defense is terrible when your offense hasn't really been stopped all day. In the first,
there was a lot of that this week. There was a lot of punting deep in the opponent's territory this week.
Oregon did the same thing. I'm like, no.
ASU as well.
Oh, I am so be aggressive. I mean, that is the only thing I miss about Chip Kelly at Oregon is his aggressiveness, and he's doing it at UCLA. It pays dividends. If you go into drives saying, listen, we got 4 downs. If you can, especially if you're, it's different if the defense is consistently stopping you. But when you've already accumulated 31, 35 points in the fourth quarter, you haven't been stopped very much. So guess what? Be aggressive. It will pay. It is better to end games with the ball in your hand than not in your hand. But you know what, Ralph? USC has their quarterback now in Keaton Slovis. 30 for 44, 406 yards, 4 TDs. The kid looks legit.
Let's be clear. Up until the fourth quarter, USC media, people in LA, people who follow this program, they were roasting the kid. They were calling for backups. They did not think that he looked good at all. And then fourth quarter Keaton Slovis, which apparently is a thing. Fourth quarter Slovis is its own thing. He emerges and throws 2 touchdown passes to get them this win. He had some really nice passes in this game. But I got to give credit to the fan-sided USC site, Reign of Troy. They tweeted this out, and I think this will blow your mind, George. Keaton Slovis in the fourth quarter this season, 35 of 45, 449 yards, 5 touchdowns, no interceptions, and a passer rating of
198.26. Damn.
Yeah.
I mean, every team in the country except for Alabama, and I mean, it's probably only like 3 or 4 teams that wouldn't trade their quarterback for that right there.
Yeah, I mean, we got to start calling him maybe Keaton Start Slovis because the way he's finishing these games in just a completely different mode.
Yeah. And I thought that Colorado on the other end had given up this season, but Mel Tucker found a way to get his team to fight. So I want to give him credit for that. Found a way to get his team to fight. Steven Montez didn't throw any interceptions, and he had thrown a bunch of bad ones. They ran the ball pretty well for 196 yards. USC wasn't able to run the ball extremely well either. I mean, aside from a long 37-yarder by Amon-Ra St. Brown, they largely held them in check. But it was Michael Pittman who went off in the second half. Him and Tyler Bonds both had over 100 yards. Drake London had another 85. I mean, this was – and Amon-Ra St. Brown had, what, 100 yards of total offense. These dudes are dangerous. And also, we saw a Laviska Shenault sighting.
Yeah. And if people have been listening to this podcast for a while, if this is your first time, welcome. But if you've been listening to this for a while, you know that we are just unabashed supporters of the USC wide receiving core. No connections to USC otherwise. We've criticized them roundly for all sorts of other things. But these receivers are so good. And as much as I believe deep in my heart that you cannot ultimately be a successful team with just a good group of wide receivers or even a dominant number one, as in Colorado's case, I think that USC owes 2 of their wins at least to this point. You know, whether it's Utah and Colorado, and maybe argue another one, just to the fact that these receivers are so good.
You are 100% right. This game and the Utah game are on the wideouts. Yes, Slovis was good, but these dudes have been making plays. And if like Slovis, if even if he had a notch down receivers, because I've said USC has the best wide receivers in the country, better than Alabama. I know Jerry Judy's really good, and the other kid there is really good as well. But as far as three deep, four deep, nobody's this good. Nobody is this good. And I know Oklahoma has CD Lamb, but and has some other players, but not they're not four or five deep like this group is. I mean, overall, now Colorado is 3-5, probably not headed to a bowl game because they would need to win three out of the last four. And USC only needs to win one more game to get to a bowl game. And they have Oregon. So they have Oregon this week. Then ASU. Then Cal and UCLA. And they only need one more win. So assuming they lose the Oregon game, the Arizona State game is going to be a dogfight, I think. And by the time they play Cal, Chase Garber should actually be back. So that could really change Cal's whole entire future. And then the UCLA game is a rivalry game. Do you see USC winning their next four games?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible. I mean, they're so good in one area. They've got a quarterback who's playing well. The offensive line is serviceable. They're finding ways to run the ball. And I think that, you know, they're probably going to get a little bit healthier at that position as the season goes on. And you just need to make one or two plays defensively. You know, you don't need to get a stop every single time. You just need to do enough. The possibility exists. Will they? Probably not. But, I mean, it would be crazy to think that it wasn't possible. I think it's highly possible that they give Oregon one of their toughest challenges of the season next week. But I don't necessarily think that that means that they're, you know, I'm not guaranteeing four wins or anything like that, but I would not be surprised with if it happened, and I'm probably looking at 3-1 as the most realistic outcome.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Most realistic. The next game up in the day was Arizona and Stanford. We both were right on this game in that we said that if Jack West starts, Stanford gets housed. I mean, because they got destroyed by UCLA with Jack West at quarterback. They couldn't run the ball, couldn't pass it. KJ Costello comes back, 30 for 43, 312 yards, three touchdowns. They are an entirely different team. And Arizona did the unthinkable again. They keep switching quarterbacks. Khalil Tate, 17 for 34, a tick over 50%. Two touchdowns, two interceptions. They bring Grant Gunnell in when the game is still well in reach. He goes 7 for 7 with a touchdown. Why do you take him out?
Well, I mean, I'm so confused. He also got himself sacked twice and had the most egregious fumble of the entire weekend in college football. So, I mean, switching them back and forth for a second, it was weird because we all know if you have two quarterbacks, you don't have one quarterback, right? Like we all know this. It has been ingrained in our minds as football fans, as people who've been around the game. You played the game. I'm sure you've been in situations where there were quarterback controversies and you had to settle on one because if you have more than one quarterback, you don't have a quarterback. And for a second, I got fooled because I was like, oh, how genius is it to put Khalil Tate in there and then to spell him for a drive with somebody who brings a completely different element. And then the defense doesn't necessarily know what's going on. Well, guess what? It took two quarters for Stanford and David Shaw and all the brainiacs over there to figure out what would happen when each quarterback was in. The quarterbacks combined played relatively well on the day. Khalil Tate finally, for the first time in 2 years, had more than 100 yards rushing against a Pac-12 opponent. Grant Gunnell, you know, he goes in there, he throws seven passes. He's accurate, but obviously they can sell out on the blitz when he's in the game. And the entire thing falls apart. And University of Arizona managed to do something that I didn't even think was even possible going into the game, which is leave the fans pissed off at both quarterbacks. A fan base that wants nothing more than to move on from the Khalil Tate experiment is now mad at everybody. And the truth is, the problem wasn't even either quarterback in this game, as dumb as it was to be playing them both. It was the defense. The defense, KJ Costello shredded them, absolutely shredded them. And so I don't really know what to say here. Arizona did something bad at the quarterback position that they shouldn't have done, but the quarterbacks didn't give up 41 points.
Oh, I 100% agree, dude. This was on the coaches. This was on Kevin Sumlin. But I will say I did like the fight that we saw from Stanford, and we will get into all of that as the week goes on. The next game up was the UCLA Bruins and the Arizona State Sun Devils. We covered all the egregious penalties and plays in the game, but now UCLA has themselves in a really good spot in the conference. They mathematically are still alive in conference play inexplicably. And if they can win out, which would include a Utah win, which is not going to happen. I do not, mind you, I'm not a crazy man. I do not believe that that's going to happen. They can win the South, but the biggest question I think, Ralph, is what the heck is going on with Arizona State, dude? This UCLA team was falling apart. And until the fourth quarter, yeah, where they scored 22 points, they were getting housed.
Yeah, I don't think that you should make any excuses for Arizona State in this game. You know, there's a pretty good chance that the officiating gifted UCLA 18, but ultimately that doesn't matter because it was 35-7 at one point. Here's the thing with Chip Kelly. Do you remember Mortal Kombat on arcade, came out on Super Nintendo as well? There was that one move where you could sweep the leg, right? And and whoever you were fighting fell on their back. And in the time that it took you to get back up, you could just sweep the leg again. And if you got them into that trap, you could trip them about 18 times in a row and win the fight.
Yeah. Yeah.
You remember that? Yeah. So that used to happen to me all the time. It pissed me off. When
people Okay? M Bison, you should just be able to just slide on into them.
But like, so that's Chip Kelly. If something is working, he's going to keep doing it until you stop him. And then when you stop him, and this was his issue in the NFL, and then when you stop him, he's going to just keep doing it anyway to see if it'll work again. There were so many games where like the Eagles or the Niners got up early in the first half on somebody, and then they got come back on because one team would make adjustments and Chip Kelly wouldn't do it. So Chip Kelly saw that the 3-3-5 is a little bit soft up the middle. He knows that Arizona State's defensive line is a liability. And he's like, hey, nobody's really tested them on this yet. Let's just run. What's the whole Marshawn Lynch thing? Run through an MF of space again and again and again and again.
And over and over again. Yep.
So that's what you saw. It was effective. You and I talked about the fact that Dorian Thompson-Robinson has sort of entered this, like, which I think you've switched being a fan of. I like it, of just not caring. He's not going to make the tough throws. He's going to throw when a receiver's open. He's going to use his athleticism to create room to possibly make that throw. And if it doesn't work, he's going to check down. And he's just going to find open space. He is playing loose. You know, at this point, there's really nothing to lose. Any bad thing about UCLA and DTR has been said. So he's just going to go out and he's going to take what you give him. And it's turned him into a massive threat of a football player. And I like that about him. He did that against Arizona State. Arizona State never made any adjustments of any kind until it was far too late. And they made this UCLA offense look incredible. Just incredible.
And that's what leads me to believe that UCLA is trending in the right direction. And I don't know what Jerry Azzanaro did, whether he listened to the podcast, listened to the Pac-12 Apostles, and we were calling for his head. But he stopped Eno Benjamin, 13 carries, 46 yards. And this was a team that was Swiss cheese against the run and Swiss cheese against the pass, but they are headed in the right direction at this point.
Yeah. I would say this is a big thing for ASU in this game was everybody went into that Utah after that Utah game. Everybody was like, why don't you just give the ball to Brandon Ayuk? Why don't you run the ball more? And so ASU came into the UCLA game where you should be able to run at them and throw over them. And they executed an offensive game plan that probably should have been reserved for Utah. So it's almost like ASU's on a delay. Like next week, in 2 weeks, you're going to see them try to go deep, you know, because that's what they should have done against UCLA. So it just feels like everything ASU is doing right now is a too late adjustment.
The next game up in the day, which we can just spend a second on, because this was a disaster. An epic disaster. Cal at Utah. I mean, Cal has the lowest margin for error of any Pac-12 team in terms of winning and losing. The smallest margin of error. So their defense knows that they have to, you know, if they give up more than 15 points, they're going to lose. And in the Utah game, they were more dominant in this game than in the Arizona State game. I mean, they gave up nothing. And Cal is, yeah. I mean, they kept putting their defense in a bad position. I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to play if you're Cal. I mean, it's a bad look for Justin Wilcox, the fact that he doesn't have a backup quarterback. I mean, well, he's on the third stringer now. But, dude, I just feel really, really bad for this team because they have such good players on defense, and Spencer Brash was bad. Robbie Roel came in. He was bad. I mean, what? They were held to 83 yards of total offense. 83. So in 2 weeks, Utah has held teams to 3 points. Mind you, are bad offensive teams, but still. What? No, sorry. Cal's a bad offensive team. ASU's reasonable. Held them to 3 points and like a combined 230 yards of total offense. This team, it is dominant, and there's a lot of people who think they may be the best team in the Pac-12 right now.
They've had some good fortune, let's be honest, right? They've played three true freshman quarterbacks now. They were able to knock one out of the game, and it worked against them. But they're averaging giving up less than 10 passing yards a quarter over the last 8 quarters, which might be the most insane stat I've ever heard in the modern game of football. But I mean, a lot of it at this point has been
playing young.
They have the talent,
and they're playing young tackles.
Sell them short on any of this. Tyler Huntley probably shouldn't have been in the game. I mean, after the first quarter yesterday, it probably wasn't even necessary. He looks a little bit beat up. Offensively, though, Zach Moss is the absolute real deal. I don't think that anybody else as a running back right now is in his class just as far as a workhorse. You know, there maybe are players that are more dynamic or more athletic, but there's no true first, second, third down running back like Zach Moss in the Pac-12 right now. This is a good football team that has also experienced a little bit of good fortune. And all you can do is win the games in front of you. And that's, I mean, they're doing it in dominant fashion. And, we talk about the fact that it took Oregon until the last play. It took USC until the fourth quarter to beat opponents that they're clearly better than. Well, UCLA's not even messing around with that. At this point in the season, if they are more talented than another team, it's going to show on the scoreboard.
And for some reason, styles make fights. And this is a style that Oregon has a ton of trouble stopping. And it just felt like between the refs and a couple times not getting off the field, Washington State, because Oregon was up at 10 at one point in time and had a chance to get off the field on third down. And then the refs make a horrible call. Mario Cristobal gets a personal foul. If you get a personal foul after the refs have to reverse a call because you made a terrible call, you should get that personal foul rescinded.
I agree. I mean, we've seen that. I've I was watching a Phoenix Suns game yesterday, and the same thing happened. You can challenge a call in basketball now, and they teed somebody up for arguing the call, challenged the call, and it got overturned with the technical foul stance. And I hate that. You should own it. If you're a referee and you make the wrong call, you should own other people's reaction to your ineptitude.
Oh, I 100% agree with that. I 100%. So are you all in on the Ducks right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still waiting for your apology for disparaging Arizona State's defensive backs after you saw what Anthony Gordon is actually capable of, going over 400 yards against the Ducks DBs. That offense, that is what it is. They hit the open receiver again and again and again, and there's all you can do is keep them in front of you. That's the only thing that you can really do, is try to not make a mistake once they've completed the pass. But yeah, I mean, I feel like even with some effery by the refs, that you know, Oregon getting this win, showing that they can get it done on special teams, was a big deal.
I almost had a heart attack, Ralph. I didn't even watch the last kick. I went upstairs and said goodnight to my daughter because I couldn't watch. I'm excited to see what comes with Thursday. You guys, make sure that you listen to the Thursday podcast. Pac-12 Apostles, George Reister, Ralph Amsden, we appreciate your time, appreciate your energy. Peace out. Catch you guys later.